to death.
12 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to Night Talk. My name is Oliver Dixon. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Really appreciate the honor and the privilege of your time. The asbestos case in the Bloemfontein High Court has once again been postponed, Ace Magashule being one of the accused in that case. But I thought, before we get into the minutiae of the case, let's perhaps understand the ambit of the law that this case activates, so to speak. Ian Ellis, who's a criminal lawyer, joins us for this. Ian, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. PRECCA is a relatively young law as far as South Africa's jurisprudence overall is concerned. What is it? What does it hope to do? And how successful has PRECCA been as far as developing the jurisprudence of preventing corruption?
Good evening, Oliver, and good evening to the listeners. It's a pleasure to be with you guys this evening. PRECCA was an act that was basically brought into law only in 2004. So we're talking about a pretty new piece of legislation,
yeah,
if one could actually say that. Now, when one actually looks at it, it's implemented to help combat bribery and corruption-based crime. So that ties up also into our other laws, naturally, it's our Criminal Procedure Act, but also in terms of what's called the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. So ultimately, at the end of the day, it's a further what's called a bootstrap form of statute. So what that is to add some extra punch. If one looks now at the new cyber crimes law that's come in, it's basically to facilitate all those type of actions of that nature. So in terms of this, it's basically to bring all of the ideas of bribery and corruption under one umbrella to make it easier to charge than just going down fraud this way, theft that way, yeah, corruption that way. So it's to basically bring everything together and so a bit of an easier pattern, if one could say, to try and prosecute crimes of this nature.
Yeah. Before we get into some of the statutes or some of the provisions in the Act, let me perhaps ask you this, because I think it relates overall to the legislative framework and just crystallizing it for South Africans in a way that it becomes tangible. What are some of the big, I guess, case law moments in the lifespan of PRECCA since 2004? What are some of the big cases that has emanated out of this legislation?
Well, we see this was one of those, the Ace Magashule matter. There's been other also corruption matters and bribery issues with regards to tenders of various natures. I think that also came into effect, if one looks at it, on what was actually charged in terms of the state capture commission and certain of those corruption charges and the directions that were implemented. And let's also not forget the recent charges that have been levied against the deputy speaker and former Minister of Defence. Those are also going to form under the PRECCA legislation.
Yeah. So let's now get into the minutiae related to some of the facts that we know about the case. And I will admit, the facts about the case are varied, they're dense, and they're extensive. It involves one person who was key in this, who's unfortunately dead now, passed away. We'll come to him. His name is Ignatius Mpambene. And we're going to be speaking about the admissibility of his evidence, which is crucial in this because it links Ace Magashule in particular. But let's talk about very specifically what Ace Magashule is being accused of. And here, some of the evidence we know, as Peter Louis Myburgh, investigative journalist, had documented for us already in 2019 in his seminal work, Gangster State, that Mpambene, who went into a joint venture, he is the CEO of a company called Diamond Hill. Diamond Hill went into a joint venture with a company called Black Hat Consulting, and together they formed the Black Hat Diamond Hill joint venture. They were awarded an unsolicited tender, or at least was successful in an unsolicited bid, of asbestos. It turned out that there were a lot of homes built during apartheid, which were built with asbestos roofs that we later learned through advancement of medical sciences was the cause of various illnesses, including cancer. But it was unclear to the government at the time, at least the Free State government, how many houses have asbestos roofs. And so an audit needed to be done. This joint venture was then appointed, or at least this joint venture, after having submitted a bid, was successfully given this particular tender. And it cost, they billed the government of the Free State, the Department of Human Settlements, 230 million rand, while this tender was priced at 255 million rand. And all they really did was go to homes and say, hey, can we look at your roof? Do you have an asbestos roof? And it turns out some homes did, some homes didn't, and a report was compiled. Turns out the actual work cost less than 30 million rand, and many companies down the line were being subcontracted to do the actual work. Given all of those facts, and we now know from Peter Louis Myburgh's seminal work that kickbacks were being paid. And some of those kickbacks, the allegations are, were paid from Ignatius Mbambeni to Ace Magashule in cash. And he forensically traces instances where Mbambeni would have a meeting with Ace Magashule or would meet Ace Magashule at various places, many times his home. And every time Ignatius would go to Ace Magashule, he would stop by the nearest ATM and withdraw large sums of cash, 100,000 rand, 150,000 rand. And the assumption is that those cash were the kickbacks that he needed to pay Ace Magashule. At some point, there's an allegation that similar kickbacks were made to Nomvula Mokonyane, but we'll get to that at a later stage. There's no actual evidence that is provable that that happened because Ignatius Mbambeni is dead. He was killed in 2017 in November, shot in his Bentley in Sandton, and he's dead. He was the money bag man. So what actually, Ian, is Ace Magashule being accused of here?
It's basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to bootstrap these position with certain other people's testimony. There are other statements that have been made against him. But this is why they are, the state is to a huge degree on the back foot in this matter. And they also are trying to go ahead and bolster their position. In essence, Magashule has been charged with corruption and receiving of bribes. That's what it translates to in the simplest term, or otherwise known as a contravention of the certain provisions and clauses relating to PRECA, yep, as well as a contravention of the Criminal Procedure Act, as well as the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, because he was working in terms of a syndicate. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, where the charges stem from is that because it was an unsolicited tender, and also at that stage when this was originally given, if I'm not mistaken, Magashule was still the premier of the Free State at that stage. And that's what opened it up to these charges, because the orders, in essence, for that tender came directly through the top tier of the premier's office. And that is where he actually became implicated in it, was from where the network actually started and where the connections actually lay. And that's basically what they're trying to do is set, if one could call it, almost like an organogram of a hierarchy of where it came in, and that's how they've linked him. So they've almost like played it backwards to the top rather than from the top down.
Yeah. Some of the claims is that even in the instance where it is not proved that Ace Magashule received cash kickbacks, but he knew that this tender was irregularly awarded and he knew that this tender was drastically overpriced it was unduly and illegally overpriced. And because he knew that and did nothing about it, he is guilty of some crime. Explain to us how the act works in terms of that.
Yeah. There's also if you actually take a look at it as well, it was also the fact that it was awarded to entities that in reality did not have the infrastructure to conduct the job. So it's basically like me being a lawyer, but me procuring a tender to be a plumber.
Yeah.
So there's no way that you had the capabilities, which that meant that when a tender of that nature is actually driven out, everything must be investigated from the experience to what the company in actual fact is. So that also, it basically forms part of a criminal enterprise. So that is how he gets implicated in terms of his actions, or shall I say, in this case, the omission by not, if one could see it, could say, from the Premier's office, directly looking into the entity that was given the tender, and auditing that company as the rules with regards to tender are supposed to be given. Because when a tender is supposed to be awarded, there needs to be certain homework done and due diligence paid, in which each and every one of the offerors or the tender parties wish to go ahead and tender on. And one needs to look at all the various companies as well as what the quote in actual fact is and whether it is valued. So by him, in essence, turning a blind eye, created the suspicion. And furthermore, by the fact of how these guys actually got the tender on an unsolicited basis showed that there was some sort of an inroad directly into the Premier's office to gain that tender.
Yeah. Let's talk about then Ignatius Mbamini, who is a key figure in here. He was assassinated in his Bentley by hitmen in 2017, a couple of weeks before the ANC's elective conference at Nasrec. I mention that parenthetically, but it's an important fact, albeit not germane to the conversation right now. He is an important figure. It's his companies and his company's bank statements and travel records and cell phone records that is an important piece of information. But he's dead. He's no longer alive. To what extent does his evidence become admissible and usable in court?
You see, the problem always comes when any party dies during the proceedings or prior to the proceedings, is the aspect that their statement can never be cross-examined. So automatically, from the defense's point of view, you're going to argue the inadmissibility. From the state perspective, they'll obviously try and use the concept of the best possible evidence available in any statements that they have procured from him, or evidence, there's the objective evidence and the oral testimonial-based evidence. If they have a statement from him, but obviously he's not allowed to present it, there's going to be an argument from a trial perspective of whether it should be admitted. Other aspects which are more objective evidence, which relate to, say, for example, his travel arrangements, the bank statement, the Section 205 subpoenas issued against the bank statements of the joint venture, those could still be brought in without him having to confirm it, because there are other witnesses for that purposes. But the actual transactions of the supposed switching over of money, from the state's perspective, they're going to have to show that there is no other better evidence that can be used, and as such, that there was also the action, that the hit was used exactly for this purpose, and that was to go ahead and silence a potential witness.
Yeah. And so let's talk then about some of the evidence, right? That is objective but without context. So Ignatius Mbamini meets Ace Magashule at a particular hotel. Just before Ignatius meets Ace Magashule at that hotel, Ignatius stops at a local garage, withdraws 150,000 rand, and 5 minutes later he's at this particular meeting. And this pattern holds for a very long time, where each time Ignatius would meet Ace Magashule, he would stop at an ATM, withdraw large sums of money, usually ranging between 100,000 rand to 300,000 rand. Sometimes they would meet out of country. For instance, Ace Magashule was on an official visit to Cuba at one time. Ignatius, who's not a state official and who had no interest in that particular state visit, was in Cuba with Ace Magashule, and there was an exchange. There was records of withdrawals of cash and transfers thereof. Similarly, when Ace Magashule at one particular time visited the USA, while in the USA on an official state visit, Ignatius was there too. This pattern describes something that you and I could reasonably conclude: oh, that is the money bag guy. He's the money runner. But we have no way of confirming that, unless, of course, Ignatius would have made an admission under oath in testimony about that. If so, Ace Magashule and all the other accused should have the opportunity to cross-examine that particular testimony or whatever the case may be. With Ignatius being dead, I don't think and I don't see that evidence holding in trial. The NPA seems to be on the back foot here.
They will be on the back foot unless, and this is going to take some, and this is why I also see that there's this constant protracting of the case and that the case is never really ripe to proceed, considering it's been going on for years now. I wouldn't be surprised if the NPA are still trying to go ahead and link some way to go ahead and say that there's a criminal conspiracy in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, which, let me put it in this way, you're dealing with an umbrella of statutes which we can go into, but if they can tie then some involvement, if, and hypothetically I'm thinking of what SAFE would be looking at doing, is to tie Magashule in with the murder of Ignatius, then that will basically give them the inroad that they don't necessarily need evidence, but that created the motive and that created the basis behind them going ahead and upping the charges to further criminal conspiracy to murder.
Yeah. Let's talk about postponements quickly. They're commonplace in court, and what we know about this particular trial, the postponements were because one of the accused is not of good health, is ill, and two other accused do not have legal representation. And so it's once again been postponed to the 14th of July, and this case has had postponements as far back as, what, 2019. It may seem to some people that, well, it's going to be postponed indefinitely in perpetuity. This case will never actually begin. Talk to us about postponements and how judges typically make those decisions. At what point does a judge say, I've had enough, I'm fed up, let's begin this trial?
A lot of it comes down to the magistrate or the judge themselves, depending upon how tolerant they in actual fact are of it. It also comes down to the fact of whether there is merit in the postponement. And I've also seen, unfortunately, there becomes, because it's a high-profile matter, people are taking notice of it. Unfortunately, and I'm saying this from experience as a criminal defense attorney, is that it's becoming more commonplace. I've seen postponement for any reason whatsoever, including there's not enough time and there was an electricity or water problem in the courtroom. So the fact is, it's just because this is a high-profile matter that it's highlighting the problems where postponements are being granted and lengthy postponements.
Yeah.
For very limited reasons. But unfortunately, because of the nature of our constitution and the rights that are afforded to an accused person, the fact that one wants to have legal representation, cannot procure that legal representation, it will lead to a fair amount of postponements until the magistrate, or in this case, alternatively a judge, puts their foot down and says, whether you've now had X amount of time, this has been postponed, you need to go ahead, it's been set down. If you don't have somebody, then you're defending yourself. And at the same time, also saying to the state, if you're not ready and you're not complying with what needs to be given, then your matter's going to be struck off the roll. We cannot proceed just to delay and delay and delay in hopes that you can tie your case together.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time this evening. I really do appreciate it. Ian Ellis, criminal attorney.